It's time for Northwestern Outdoors Radio, the show focusing on fishing, hunting, outdoor recreation, destinations, and conservation in the region where you live and play. Northwestern Outdoors is brought to you by Max Lure Company, Sportsman's Warehouse, and Wallowa County. And now, let's see what's going on in the field and on the water with your host, John Cruz.
Here's a question for you. What fish comes to mind when it comes to stalking fish in Wyoming? Trout, right? That's certainly my thought, but over the last couple of weeks, Wyoming Game and Fish have stalked 6,000 good-sized channel catfish measuring 13 to 14 inches each in community ponds all over the Cowboy State. For our listeners tuning in from Sundance, Ranchester, and Sheridan, some of these stocked ponds are where you live, including the Sundance Fairgrounds Pond, the Ranchester City Pond, and Mafricus Pond in Sheridan. I've got very fond memories of learning to fish and catching pumpkin seeds and catfish out of a community pond in Glenmere Park in Greeley, Colorado when I was a young boy. If you're looking for something fun to do with your kids or grandkids, do the same thing. Take them down to one of these stock ponds in Wyoming, rig up a worm under a bobber, and let them reel it in slow. They'll probably catch some of those catfish, and you'll all have a pretty fun day on the water. This week on the show, we've got all sorts of hot button topics to cover. We've got news about the Lower Snake River dams, a polarizing subject for many who argue economics versus salmon recovery. We've got news about gill netting and wild steelhead harvest and sales on the Columbia River, something some of the same politicians arguing for dam breaching seem to be supporting. In addition to this, we'll also talk about two dams being demolished in Western Washington and the fight to stop another one from being built in that part of the state when we chat with Chase Gannell, the very well-spoken communications director for a nonprofit organization called Conservation Northwest. And why stop at dams when you can push more hot buttons and talk about wolves? They are causing problems again in Northeast Washington this summer, where they're once again killing livestock, and once again, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife is killing some of these wolves that are doing this after trying an assortment of non-lethal means that didn't work. Chase Gannell will weigh in on this subject too, and why wolves are seemingly bottlenecked in Northeast Washington and not expanding through the state as hoped. He does have one proposed solution to this, but I will tell you, this is a very, very controversial thing he and others are looking at doing to repopulate wolves in other parts of the Evergreen State. We'll tell you more about this just after the bottom of the hour. After that, we're right back to the Columbia and Snake Rivers when we talk to Eric Winther with the Northern Pike Minnow Sport Reward Fishery Program. Now, this is a program I think just about all of us can get behind, because you catch pike minnow, which eat salmon and steelhead smolt, and then you turn in those pike minnow for money, sometimes some really serious money. Eric will tell you where the fishing is hot right now and a little bit more about how this program works. Last but not least, we've got not only our ever-popular Sportsman's Warehouse Trivia Question of the Week giveaway from America's Premier Outfitter, but also another giveaway from our friends at Worksharp worth $110 that we're doing on our sister show, America Outdoors Radio, and we'll tell you how you can participate in that giveaway and maybe get yourself some very nice sharpeners this summer. Before we do all of this, though, it's time to check in again with David Sparks, who has an old friend of mine on the air, who is also a very passionate conservationist and fisherman, Josh Mills.
A principle called overlining makes a lot of sense for fly fishermen. David Sparks, this is Sportsman Spotlight. Our good friend Josh Mills tells me that there's a nifty way to get line out for a fly fisherman without having to overwork it, and it's called overlining.
If you're out fly fishing and you're casting either a sinking line or really big bugs and you're feeling like you're constantly having to really work hard to get line out, to shoot it, to even manage it, let me introduce a principle that it might help you out for people who are starting out. It's the principle of overlining your fly rod. So let's say that you normally fish with a 5-weight line. Feel free to possibly switch up to a 6-weight line on your 5-weight rod, because what that's going to do is provide a deeper load in the rod. You'll be able to shoot more line. There's nothing worse than being out all day long and getting something that doesn't quite match, and you're having to constantly work to get line out, or you're casting big bugs and it's hard to get the line to load the rod properly, and therefore it's just effort upon effort upon effort. So coming up a line size to the rod, especially as you get into the heavier type stuff, if you're fishing an 8-weight, don't be scared to put a 9-weight line on that rod. Modern line manufacturers most of the time overweight it a little bit and go a little bit above what a 5-weight really would be. But if you step up to the 6-weight and it's a specific application, it's not going to be that great if you're throwing dry flies. But if you're throwing subsurface stuff, big streamers or big heavy flies to bass deep or something like that, try overlining. It'll make your day a lot more enjoyable.
David Sparks, Sportsman Spotlight.
Welcome back to TikTok, because ticks happen. Today's topic, clinical anaplasmosis carried by ticks. Carol in the Corral, you're on TikTok.
I'm just not myself. I'm weak, pale, losing weight.
Oh, we will get you help. Stay on the line. Next, we have Patty in the Pen, who's feeling a bit anemic.
It's hard to breathe, and I'm constipated.
Yeah.
And these guys never stop mooing.
And clearly a bit agitated. My dear callers, these are all signs of clinical anaplasmosis brought on by ticks, but it's not your fault.
Ticks happen.
But there is a new treatment for your tick-induced troubles. New Baytril 100 CA1 Enrofloxacin Injectable. Baytril 100 CA1 is conditionally approved for the treatment of clinical anaplasmosis associated with Anaplasma marginale for certain cattle.
Ask your cattle veterinarian for a product label to see if this product is for you. Veterinary prescription required. Extra label use is prohibited.
New Baytril 100 CA1.
Welcome back to Northwestern Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz. We've got a special guest on the show today. I've been wanting to get on the air for a long time. His name is Chase Gannell. He is the communications director for Conservation Northwest, a 4,000-member strong organization that advocates for conservation in our environment with a focus on Washington State and British Columbia. Chase, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. I'm really glad to be here. Appreciate the invitation.
Well, you know the old saying, you should never discuss politics or religion at dinner because people get very passionate about these topics and that dinner might devolve into a shouting match. And here in the Northwest, I think you could add two other topics to that list. That would be dams, hydropower dams, and wolves. And if you and I are going to discuss both today, we're going to start off with dams. We'll get to wolves later during the show. And I'm kind of looking forward to this because there's a lot of controversy over dams, and there's a lot of good reasoning on both sides. I'm not going to really get to the Snake River dams today, because that could take the whole hour of the show, but I do want to talk about dams in Western Washington, where dams are actually being removed to restore habitat for salmon and steelhead. Why don't you tell our listeners what rivers are having dams removed right now, and why this is finally happening?
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that. And as someone who's an avid fisherman myself, you know, this is a big subject for folks across the Pacific Northwest, not only in Washington and Western Washington, but down into Oregon and California, where they have some dam removal projects in the works as well. But here in my neck of the woods, you know, the big story has been the Elwha Dam removal. But if you've been paying attention more recently, there's two other projects that have been in the news that are really promising for Chinook salmon and other species. The big one most recently is the Nooksack Dam removal up there near Bellingham. That's a project that's been in the works for about 20 years. My organization, Conservation Northwest, works very closely with the Lummi Tribe and the Nooksack Tribe to gain an agreement from the city of Bellingham to remove that fish-blocking dam. It was one of those dams that provided diversion for water supply that was no longer necessary, and now all it was doing was blocking Chinook from getting to their spawning ground. And here we are 20 years later, and a group called American Rivers and the state, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Nooksack Tribe and other partners have met that goal. They're in the process of ripping it out right now, and they're going to be opening up, I think, more than 15 miles of spawning habitat for Chinook. It's going to be a big benefit for those fish.
Now, we've
another
got a
project.
Sorry to cut in on you there, but there's a...
No, not at all.
I understand there's another river down towards Snohomish County near Everett, the Pilchuck River. Is there a dam being removed there, too?
That's right. That's exactly what I was just going to go to. So that's actually where I grew up, steelhead and salmon fishing, right there in the Snohomish and Duval area. And it's really exciting that in a similar project, the Pilchuck Dam is being removed. And that's a partnership between the Tulalip tribes, the city of Snohomish, and the state. And again, we're going to see big benefits for Chinook salmon. The Pilchuck, while a pretty small river, actually has a quite a sizable run of wild steelhead still. It's sort of a sleeper system when it comes to steelhead returns. It kind of flies under the radar, and this is going to be a big boost for those fish. And we look at the status of Chinook and steelhead and Puget Sound. They need all the help they can get, and we're really excited about that Pilchuck project as well as the one up on the Nooksack.
Well, I've got to tell you, I'm pretty excited about it, too. I looked at the task force that was looking at saving the southern resident killer whales, and they're in big trouble. And the reason they're in big trouble is because of a number of reasons, but one major reason is a lack of food, that food being Chinook salmon in particular. And I know they get a certain percentage of their food from salmon that come down the Snake River, but the main source for them are the salmon in Puget Sound. So to have these tributaries that flow into Puget Sound have dams removed, this is really promising long-term to help not only the salmon runs, but these killer whales too.
It is, and to help out anglers, local communities, it's really a win-win. You mentioned tributaries, and that's exactly the focus here. When you look at salmon recovery across Puget Sound and the region, we have so many of these smaller tributaries, whether it's the Middle Fork Nooksack or the Pilchuck or even some of these smaller creeks that have been blocked with diversion dams. That's where habitat restoration is needed most. And if we can start chipping away at some of those blockages, whether it's a culvert or a dam, it's going to have exponential benefits for the fish.
Let's go ahead and talk about an evolving success story, and that's the removal of the dam on the Elwha River in the Olympic Peninsula. I'm trying to remember how long ago that was removed, but why don't you go ahead and talk about that and what those runs are looking like now?
Yeah, I believe the dam removal project itself began in 2012 and wrapped up somewhere in the neighborhood of 2015, but the work to approve that removal was more than three decades in the making, and folks like the leadership at our organization, a number of national groups, the Lower Elwha Squalum Tribe, and the National Park Service, they really led the effort, and it was ultimately successful in getting federal funding to tear down the Elwha dams, which were built illegally to begin with, in that they did not have fish passage, despite being on one of the best salmon streams on the Olympic Peninsula and really in the Lower 48 itself. So as that project has progressed and those dams have come down, it's been really neat to see how the ecosystem has responded, not just the fish, but also the elk and other wildlife that use that area. And when it comes to the fish, the response has been quicker than I think just about anyone imagined. We're already seeing a significant turnaround of wild steelhead that are now spawning above the dam site. Many of those may have been rainbow trout that had residualized, trapped behind the dam and couldn't make it out to the ocean. Well, now they have, and they're coming back, and their offspring are using the whole stretch of river that was formerly not available to them. We're also seeing Chinook salmon spawning above the dam. All five species of salmon use the Elwha River, and it's really an exciting case study of where dam removal can be successful. It's still in the early phases. You know, we're only a little more than 5 years in now, but it's going to be a promising project to watch into the future and hopefully an inspiration for more dam removal projects, places where we can find agreement with the community to make sure that their needs, whether it's water or power, are met, but also to support recovering these ecosystems and the fish themselves.
You know, these are great success stories that we're talking about here, but they're still talking about building dams in Western Washington. And the newest one is a proposal to build a dam on the Chehalis River to control flooding that does happen in that region on a pretty regular basis. Now, Governor Jay Inslee has weighed in saying he hopes a dam is not going to be built there. And I'm sure your organization feels the same way. What would the impacts of a dam be here to fish and wildlife?
So the proposal to dam the Chehalis River was something that came out of the local flood control districts and some of the local counties in response to really massive flooding that has occurred in that watershed over the last two decades. We have seen some very significant flood impacts. We certainly don't want to minimize those. The Chehalis watershed is the second largest river that runs entirely within Washington. It's a broad valley that historically would have seen very large floods. And over the last century of logging and agriculture, river straightening and dredging, that valley has been impacted and changed in ways that have exacerbated the flooding. And that's a big deal for local communities and farmers. We want to find a way to reduce those flood impacts, but we really don't think that another $1 billion dam, and that's what it's projected to cost, is the solution. So this dam would be in the headwaters of the mainstem Chehalis River, which is one of the best salmon and steelhead watersheds we have left in Washington. It's actually one of the few areas where Chinook salmon are not listed under the Endangered Species Act because they're still doing relatively well. And that's just not the kind of thing that we want to put at risk through the building of a new dam. And in fact, that dam would be in an area that is right in the path of Chinook, coho, and steelhead spawning. It's right where these fish go to spawn. And as soon as that dam's built, they would lose that habitat. And it's also in an area that's critical for elk and black-tailed deer, black bears. It's a major migratory corridor through the Willapa Hills, right in the area where the dam is proposed to be built, and it would have impacts on those species as well.
So many more questions, and we aren't even going to be able to get to the Snake River, so we'll have to leave that for another time. But I'd like you to hang on so we can talk about wolves. That's another hot topic here in the Northwest and in Washington State. Until that time, though, folks, if you have a minute, go to the Conservation Northwest website. You'll find it at conservationnorthwest.org. Again, conservationnorthwest.org. This is an organization that's not just involved with dams and wolves, but all sorts of other projects too. Check it out. Definitely worth your time. Chase, looking forward to getting you back on the air in just a few minutes.
All right. Thank you.
Go fishing, help salmon, and make money. You can do it through September 30th by catching northern pike minnow and turning them in for cash. Here's how it works. First, register at a designated station on the Columbia or Snake River. Then, go fishing. At the end of the day, turn in any pike minnow you catch 9 inches or longer and look for the ones with tags worth $500. You'll get vouchers for those pike minnow you turn in, and you mail those in for cash. Find out more at pikeminnow.org.
With more of the great outdoors on Northwestern Outdoors Radio with John Cruz.
We've got a special Max Minute for you today, and we're going to be focusing on sockeye fishing at Lake Wenatchee in Washington Central Cascades. With us here to tell you exactly how to do this and get some of those sockeye to your boat is Bob Loomis. Bob, great to have you on the air.
Thanks, John.
So let's talk about the sockeye lure anglers ought to use for success at Lake Wenatchee during the month of August.
John, there's a lot of things that you can use, but some of the stuff that I'm going to start out with right off the bat is the Double Whammy Sockeye Pro. The Double Whammy Sockeye Pro is high UV beads or glow beads with a smile blade on there. Just a basic setup. It's great for attraction for the sockeye. Works fantastic behind a Double D Dodger. You know, you can slow troll it. You get the added movement, the color, the flash. It works really, really well for the sockeye up there.
So a couple of questions when it comes to this. When you're tying this sockeye rig behind the Dodger, I've heard that for sockeye that you use a really short leader. How short should you go?
Well, the typical rule of thumb on any type of leader length compared to your Dodger is 2.5 times. I'll tell you quite truthfully, with the large 8-inch Double D, I've fished as short as 7 inches.
Wow.
I mean, and it's what it does is it imparts a tremendous amount of movement on the lure.
Okay, so we'll just go ahead and say anywhere from 7 to 18 inches then?
Correct.
All right. What about speed?
Well, speed for sockeye, you're going to want to fish slow. It's like fishing kokanee. It's not like out in the saltwater fishing for chinooks or silvers where you're having to fish up around 2.5 to 3 miles an hour. You know, you're fishing down in that 1.1, 1.3 miles per hour range. So you're slow trolling, and that's why the Double D works really well along with that the Sockeye Pro.
All right. It's the Max Sockeye Pro and the Max Double D Dodger. Your 1-2 punch for Lake Wenatchee sockeye this summer. Look for them at sporting goods stores in Central Washington or online at maxlure.com.
Looking for that extra something that will get more salmon or trout into your boat? Then check out the Double D Dodger from Max Lure. The Double D does double duty and helps you catch more fish. The Double D's flash attracts lunkers, and the Dodger's patented stop-start action works wonders to get those fish biting. The Double D does even more by acting as a side planer to get your bait away from the boat where the fish are more likely to be and more apt to strike. The Double D Dodger, it's the Dodger you've got to have from Max Lure.
Sportsman's Warehouse is America's premier outfitter and has what you need as a hunter, angler, hiker, paddler, camper, and outdoors enthusiast. They also carry an extensive assortment of firearms and ammunition you simply can't find anymore at many big box stores. On top of that, their knowledgeable staff is here to help you purchase the right gear so you can get the most out of your outdoor experience. Visit your local Sportsman's Warehouse store today or shop online anytime at sportsmans.com.
Backcountry hunters and anglers, the men and women working hard to keep public lands in public hands. Check us out at backcountryhunters.org.
You're back in with Northwestern Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz, and you're also back in with Chase Gunnell, the Communications Director for Conservation Northwest. Earlier in the show, we had a great discussion about dams and dam removal in Washington State and the impacts dams have on fish and wildlife in the Northwest. Now, we've got another hot-button topic, wolves, and especially wolves in Washington, which are definitely causing a lot of concern and angst among lots of people. Chase, great to have you back on the air.
Thanks, John. We really are hitting some of the hot topics here. It reminds me a little bit about the conversation around the fire at my deer camp. You know, we're not straying away from anything challenging. And, you know, these are both topics that touch on a lot of folks here in Washington State, particularly as wolves have returned to the region. You know, it's something that we haven't been used to as a community, whether you're a hunter or a rancher or a conservationist. And I think there's a lot to learn.
Well, I know you've been deeply involved in this issue for quite some time, and let's get one thing out of the way right off the bat. Conservation Northwest, you support the wolf population being restored across Washington State, but for our listeners who don't know, what does a successful restoration look like according to the plan that's currently in place?
So we're what you'd call a generalist conservation group. We want to see native wildlife return to the region, but we work really hard to collaborate with local communities to find win-wins. We have staff across the region in places like Colville and Chewila, Omak and Twisp, as well as over here on the west side where I'm based. And that means we want to see this done responsibly. And we think the Washington State Wolf Plan, when it was drafted and finalized back in 2012, was a good plan. Now, 8 years later, plans do evolve, but as it's currently written, it says we want to see somewhere in the neighborhood of three wolf packs breeding successfully in a given year in three different regions across the state for a total of at least 15 wolf packs or more at minimum, but those breeding pairs are the key metric of success for the current wolf plan. Now, that has resulted in some challenges as we've seen wolf populations grow in Northeast Washington a little more slowly in the Cascades and Southeast Washington, but not yet reach the western end of the state on the Olympic Peninsula or the South Cascades. So we are now seeing quite a few more wolves in eastern Washington than I think the plan had initially expected before reaching recovery goals, but not yet seeing those successful breeding pairs in the South Cascades and the Olympic Peninsula that are a requirement of that state recovery plan that, again, was drafted back in 2012. Because of that, the state has already begun post-recovery planning, and that includes looking at options to speed up recovery and make sure that we have this native species restored to suitable habitat in the state, but done in a way that does not have undue impacts on local communities, ranchers, hunters, and game populations. We want to see this managed through science and through responsible collaboration with local communities. And as we start to get a little bit closer to those recovery goals that the state laid out, the state and partners are working to make sure that we can do that in a way that's durable, especially given the somewhat uneven recovery of wolves across the state to date.
Well, uneven is a generous way to put it. We have 26 or 27 packs of wolves in Washington State. And what is it? About 15 of them are congregated in the Northeast, where we're having the vast majority of our conflicts with livestock. Is that correct?
That's right. I think it's 14 in Northeast, and then they've got one there just above the Okanagan Valley. It is uneven. There's no doubt. You know, we were involved with drafting that wolf plan back in 2012. There was a number of independent biologists that weighed in on that plan, state wolf experts. And again, sometimes plans need to evolve. And so that's why the state and partners through the Wolf Advisory Group are looking at whether translocating some wolves from Northeast Washington to suitable areas of habitat in other parts of the state should be part of the recovery effort. what can we do to help reach those recovery goals and help return this native species to quality habitat where it does belong, but do so in a way that limits impacts on local communities and maybe take some pressure off folks in Northeast Washington where there are a lot of wolves, as you described.
Okay, you're taking me down a rabbit trail here with what you just said. In Northeast Washington, you've got these ranchers who have turned out their cattle to graze on Forest Service lands for generations. And let's be clear, Forest Service lands, they are multi-use lands. The ranchers are not the villains here for doing what they've always done before wolves entered the area. Ranchers, by and large, are trying non-lethal means. I want to talk about some of them that you're supporting in just a minute. But the idea of taking some of the wolves from this area, putting them in other areas, whether it be the Olympics or Southwest Washington, there's going to be a lot of people that are not going to be okay with this. And I really expect there's going to be a ton of pushback if this happens. Why can't we let this evolution naturally occur? The other issue I would say is that even if you translocate wolves from Northeast Washington, just like when we eliminate wolves that are problem wolves, they're going to fill in with new packs there. I mean, it's like trying to bail out a boat where you're not stopping the leak. It just fills up with water again. In this case, it'll just fill up with wolves, won't it?
It's a really good question. And I think it's one of those things that needs to be scrutinized through scientific study and public debate. It's interesting because, as you say, there have been pushback to that notion of translocating wolves, say, from Northeast Washington or Southeast Washington, Northeast Oregon to western parts of these two states, including from folks in those western areas that don't want to see wolves brought in, and even some skepticism from folks like myself and our organization who worry about what that would do for social tolerance for wolves if those animals are brought there in a government van as opposed to walking there on their own four paws. But then we've seen support from folks in Northeast Washington, including some of the local legislators there who have actually sponsored proposals to do this because they recognize that until we meet state recovery goals, it's going to be challenging to delist or downlist these wolves. And if we were to speed up progress towards those goals, it may allow their communities more flexibility in terms of managing wolves and wolf populations. So it's a complicated nut to crack, and I don't think anyone has the answer at this point. I'm certainly in an organization and others certainly looking at these translocation proposals with a keen eye in terms of whether they're responsible or not, or whether it's better to wait and let wolves recolonize these areas of suitable habitat on their own. But again, that's part of recovery planning, is looking at all the aspects and trying to figure out which one works, both in a scientific sense and in a community tolerance sense. We have to live with these animals, and we want to make sure that we're supporting local communities that operate in these areas as well.
Got to ask a question here. I guess in my mind, there's two kinds of organizations. There's conservation organizations, and there's environmental organizations. And a lot of environmental organizations are anti-hunting, anti-fishing. Conservation Northwest, do you support hunting? Do you support the lethal removal of wolves when all non-lethal deterrents, whether it be range riders or flagging or fox lights and everything else, when those things don't work, are you okay with the state removing problem wolves that keep preying on livestock?
Short answer is yes to both, but let me break it down for you. So as an organization, we support legal and ethical hunting according to the laws of the state of Washington. I'm a passionate hunter. I've got hunting licenses in three states right now, and I can't wait for the season to start. We've got several other hunters on our staff, and we're actually the Washington affiliate of the National Wildlife Federation, one of the country's largest conservation organizations, and in fact, a group founded by hunters. So we very much support hunting, but again, we're also a generalist conservation group. We want to see all native wildlife return to suitable wild areas where habitat exists, and we want to support programs for that wildlife to coexist with local communities. That includes wolves. It also includes plenty of work for species like deer and elk and moose and mountain caribou. But when it comes to that coexistence and the second part of your question, we do support the lethal removal of wolves according to protocols that the state has laid out as a last resort when necessary to reduce conflicts. And in fact, we've been on the record many times over the last 8 years supporting the lethal removal of wolves in Washington to a lot of pushback from folks that may be a bit more hardline in the environmental community. But we believe it's important to support coexistence. We fund range riders. We support other conflict avoidance programs on the ground in places like Chihuahua and Colville and the Colville National Forest. And we put a lot of effort into that every year to help keep those conflicts to a minimum. But when that doesn't work, and when chronic depredations happen, yes, we agree that in some cases you may need to go in and remove those wolves or even remove a pack.
Sounds very reasonable to me in terms of using science to guide your decision-making as opposed to emotion. It's nice to see that from a conservation and environmental group. If you want to find out more about this organization, folks, go to conservationnorthwest.org. That's the website for Conservation Northwest. Again, they're based in Seattle, and they are looking out for wildlife and habitat in Washington State and British Columbia, too. The website, one more time, conservationnorthwest.org. Chase, thanks so much for taking the time to be on Northwestern Outdoors Radio.
Thank you so much, John. I appreciate the opportunity.
Next on Northwestern Outdoors Radio, we're checking in with Eric Winther. He is with the Northern Pike Minnow Sport Reward Fishery Program. And it's been a while since we've checked to see how the catching is on this program where you catch fish and you turn them in and you make money. Eric, great to have you on the air again.
Hey, John. Good to be here, as always.
Let's give the folks that are listening today the current fishing report from the Columbia and Snake River, where this program is taking place. Where have the hot spots for pike minnow been?
Well, so far this year, a couple of hot spots. Kathlamet, which has been our top station the last 2 years in a row, has been pretty good. Washougal, which is just east of Vancouver, very good spot. High CPUE and a little over 12 fish per angler. And then up on the Snake River, right below Lower Granite Dam at Boyer Park, has also been good. We're kind of entering a little bit of a lull, but those are pretty good numbers for this time of year.
Well, I was checking the latest report. You issue one every week, and the hot spots for this last week, Kalama, Washougal, both over 13 fish per angler. That was fantastic. And Giles French, right below John Day Dam there at Rufus, Oregon. That's where I went earlier this year. I got skunked, but anglers are catching over 13 fish apiece now, too. In addition to that, 115 tagged fish have been caught so far this season. And folks, if you catch a tagged pike minnow, it's worth $500. How are the anglers that usually do this for a living doing so far this year in this COVID-shortened season?
Well, it's kind of a double whammy, John. In addition to the whole COVID thing we've all been dealing with, turns out this is a high water year. And typically our pike minnow anglers do not do as well in high water years as they do in low water years. So all the top guys, their numbers are down from average, I guess you would say. But there's still, you know, plenty of fish to be caught. We're about a little over 25,000 fish behind where we were this time last year. But I'm pretty optimistic that as the water starts to cool here, as we move later into August and into September, that there'll be some pretty good opportunities for those guys still out there fishing.
Well, not only for those serious anglers who literally is their job for 5 months as they fish for pike minnow, and one of them in his top year made $119,000 just fishing for pike minnow between May and September. I mean, for the average angler who just wants to go do this for fun and help with conservation efforts to save our salmon and steelhead and make a little money, I mean, we're coming into the best time of year, aren't we?
Yes, we will be pretty darn quick here. What happens is a lot of people get distracted by other things, whether it's kids, you know, getting ready to go back to school or jobs or salmon fishing or whatever it is. And so the river's not as full from a pike minnow point of view. And there's a lot of opportunities even in highly populated areas. So like below Bonneville Dam, for example, you can go up there in September and likely find fish from shore and do pretty darn well. That's just one example.
And the way things are looking right now, those kids might not be in school. They might not be doing after-school activities. So take them down to the river, catch some fish, make some money. And again, folks, here's how it works. You go ahead and register at one of the stations, and you can find where the stations are at pikeminnow.org. And once you're registered, you go fishing. The first 25 fish you catch are worth $5 apiece. They have to be over 9 inches long. You just take them back to the station, turn them in, and they will tally how many you've caught for the season. Between 25 and what is it, 250, there's $6?
200, yeah.
200. And then after 200, it jumps all the way up to $8. Is that right?
Yep.
And that's where the serious money starts kicking in. And again, if you catch a tagged fish, that's a $500 fish right there. And catch
for a really good day.
Oh, absolutely. And Eric, just remind our listeners again why we're catching these fish and the fact that this is not a bounty. We're not trying to exterminate pike minnow.
Well, it turns out that pike minnow are the main fish predator of baby salmon and steelhead. And so with the federal dams, their populations kind of grew, sort of exploded. And so we're just trying to crop them back down, not eradicate them because it's a native fish, just to take out 10 to 20% of the population every year.
And this is taking place, folks, on the Snake River, basically from Lewiston-Clarkston down towards the Columbia and on the Columbia River from Priest Rapids Dam all the way to the mouth. If you want to find out more about participating in this, and anybody can, just go to pikeminnow.org. That's the website. You've got till the end of September to catch some pike minnow and turn them in for vouchers, which you can turn into cash. Again, pikeminnow.org is the website. Eric, always a pleasure. Looking forward to better fishing in the weeks ahead.
It's coming, John. It's coming.
In other news from the Columbia and Snake Rivers, the federal government announced last week that they are not going to remove any of the four dams on the lower Snake River between Pasco and Clarkston, Washington. Several conservation and environmental groups, as well as politicians like Oregon's Governor Kate Brown, called for the removal of these dams to save salmon runs that have struggled to survive both downstream migrations and upstream returns to spawn. On the other hand, those who back the dams point out the electricity they generate and the severe economic impact the removal of these dams would cause by eliminating barging of agricultural products and other goods from the Palouse to the mouth of the Columbia, where they're shipped overseas. That would be devastating. The Trump administration is siding with the economic side of the House, but they are going to enact some new policies that will hopefully help with downstream and upstream migration of salmon and steelhead. Continuing with news about salmon, steelhead, and the Columbia River, the states of Oregon and Washington are poised to roll back promised reforms to gill netting and allow commercial and tribal gill netting to occur in the main stem of the Columbia River. According to several sources, Fish and Wildlife Commissions from the two states have authorized or are about to authorize tribal harvest and sale of wild steelhead from the Columbia River near Drano Lake near the mouth of the White Salmon River and also below Bonneville Dam for the next several months. According to David Moskowitz, executive director of the Conservation Angler, less than 35,000 wild fish are forecast to return up the Columbia River, a mere 30% of the average return from a decade ago. Wild steelhead, by the way, have not been kept by sport anglers on the Columbia for over 20 years because their numbers are so low. So this decision is a true disappointment from a conservation point of view. Moskowitz also points out commercial gill netters who were supposed to be out of the main stem Columbia under a bi-state agreement from 2012 will be allowed to net Chinook salmon in the main portion of the Columbia for 7 days, and no observers are allowed on board these commercial gill netting vessels to see what happens to the bycatch of steelhead that are also expected to be caught and likely killed by what are all too often non-selective gill nets. Now, to me, this is a real head-scratcher. You've got the governors of Washington and Oregon that say keeping dams is bad for the salmon, but at the same time, they seem to be saying gill netting is good and catching wild steelhead that are endangered and selling them is somehow good. Like I said, it is a head-scratcher. It just can't help but make you wonder if strong lobbying and political influence by commercial and tribal interests is driving this train instead of conservation and science. Stick around. We've got more of the outdoors coming up to include not only our Sportsman's Warehouse Trivia Question of the Week giveaway, but another giveaway too.
Go fishing, make money, help out, and have fun. That's what the Northern Pike Minnow Sport Reward Fishery is all about. From May 1st through September 30th, catch pike minnow out of the Columbia and Snake Rivers and turn them in for cash. Pike minnow eat juvenile salmon and steelhead. Each one you catch helps more juvenile fish reach the ocean. Pike minnow are worth anywhere from $5 to $8, and keep an eye out for tagged fish worth $500. Find out more at pikeminnow.org and go fishing.
Nature at its finest. That's what you'll find in Northeast Oregon's Wallowa County. Paddle a kayak or go fishing at Wallowa Lake. Hike into the Eagle Cap Wilderness or soak in the views after taking the tram to the top of Mount Howard. Then take time to explore the towns of Joseph and Enterprise. No matter how you take in this country, you're sure to enjoy it. That's the beauty of Wallowa County, and that's why we're home to one of Oregon's seven wonders. Find out more at WallowaCountyChamber.com.
How's the fishing?
If you could parachute a boat into this backcountry lake, it would be great. There's plenty of trout jumping out there, but I can't cast to them from the shore. Hey, what's that?
You may not be able to airdrop a boat here, but with Wilderness Light, you can pack an ultralight float tube in. This float tube, including the pump and fins, weighs less than 5 pounds and are compact enough to fit in my day pack. Order your Wilderness Light Ultralight Float Tube at WildernessLightFloatTubes.com.
WildernessLightFloatTubes.com?
WildernessLightFloatTubes.com. Get out where the fish are without the wait.
Backcountry Hunters and Anglers is the voice for your public lands, waters, and wildlife. From the Canadian Yukon to the Florida Everglades, we're stepping up to conserve North America's public lands, defend our hunting and fishing traditions, and expand public access to the outdoors. Our outdoor heritage depends on sportsmen and women like you speaking up for the natural resources that sustain our way of life. Find out how you can get involved at backcountryhunters.org and become a BHA member today.
Sportsman's Warehouse is America's premier outfitter and has what you need as a hunter, angler, hiker, paddler, camper, and outdoors enthusiast. They also carry an extensive assortment of firearms and ammunition you simply can't find anymore at many big box stores. On top of that, their knowledgeable staff is here to help you purchase the right gear so you can get the most out of your outdoor experience. Visit your local Sportsman's Warehouse store today or shop online anytime at sportsmans.com.
We've got time for one more shot of Northwestern Outdoors Radio with John Cruz.
I'm glad you're back. It is prime time for summer fishing, and if you need fishing gear or tackle, whether it be rods and reels, lures and flies, waders, float tubes, or anything else, the place to go is your local Sportsman's Warehouse store. There's over 100 locations across the U.S. now, so there's bound to be one near you. But if you don't want to go shopping in the store, you can always shop online anytime at sportsmans.com. And now it's time for your Sportsman's Warehouse trivia question of the week. It's all about the brown trout, which is one of my favorite fish to catch. They can get very big, and they tend to be tougher to catch than your average stocker rainbow, that's for sure. Brown trout, they're not native to the U.S. Oh no, they came from the old country and were first introduced into our United States in 1884. Here's your question. What European country did these first brown trout come from? Was it England? Was it France? Or was it Germany? If you want to venture a guess, just go to our Northwestern Outdoors Radio Facebook page, like and follow the page, look for the post thread where we've got this question, give us your answer there. If you don't do Facebook, just go to our website at northwesternoutdoors.com, go to the Contact Us page, and let us know what country the brown trout came from when it came to the United States. Was it England? Was it France or was it Germany? One lucky person who guesses right will win that $25 gift card we give away every week from Sportsman's Warehouse. Now, in addition to our Sportsman's Warehouse trivia question of the week, I want to let you know about another giveaway we are doing on our sister show Facebook page. It's our Sharp Summer Giveaway. It's brought to you by WorkSharp, and we are giving away an electric combo knife sharpener, a manual knife sharpener, and a very snazzy looking hat from WorkSharp too. WorkSharp is based in Medford, Oregon. They make fantastic knife and tool sharpeners that are sold not just here in the Northwest, but all over North America. The total value of this package is $110. And to enter, just go to our America Outdoors Radio Facebook page, like and follow the page, then go to the post where we're doing the giveaway and let us know what state you're from. That's all you have to do to enter. We will draw one lucky entrant on August 31st, and they'll get that $110 package from WorkSharp. By the way, if you're listening to this program and enjoy it, and your local station is not carrying our second show, America Outdoors Radio, ask them to do so. We cover fishing, hunting, and conservation issues from all over the nation on this hour-long show, and we'd love to share this with you, too. Just contact your local station and ask them to carry America Outdoors Radio, hosted and produced by the same guy who brings you this show every week. We've got to wrap things up, but I do hope you're making the most of this summer and spending some time outdoors. A lot of people certainly are this year, thanks to COVID-19, and I guess that's one of the few blessings we've got from all of this. Until next time, do stay healthy, do take care, God bless, and make it a point to spend some time outdoors.